Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming on the web at KSFR.org, podcasting at SantaFeRadioCafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and we're at Facebook.com/RadioCafe. Today, it's the day after Martin Luther King Day holiday, and we continue listening to Martin Luther King's sermons and our conversation with Dr. Russell Adams, Professor Emeritus of Afro-American Studies at Howard University. Let's join Dr. Adams. Martin Luther King Jr. entered college at the age of 15. He had two bachelor's degrees and a PhD in theology by the time he was 26 years old. Was he preparing for his work as a civil rights leader all along?
No. Let me say a couple of things real quick. And this is to take nothing away from going to college at the age of 15. Dr. Benjamin Elijah Mays, who became his academic and, to some extent, spiritual mentor, was president of Morehouse starting in 1940. Morehouse was about to be closed because of the draft for people who were 18. President Morehouse got permission to admit otherwise promising students at age 15 in order to keep the place open. So it is not to take away from King as a genius, but the 15 age business that's been talked about a lot. There were hundreds of guys admitted to Morehouse at age 15 in order to keep the enrollment big enough to keep a faculty. And that's not generally known. But King, as a student whose daddy was the most famous preacher in Georgia, was known as for his dressing Mr. Tweeds. He wore tweed suits when that was rare among black young fellas. And among the ladies, he was known as the Wrecker, meaning that he was a very popular fellow with the ladies while he was 15 and 16 and 17. Now, Morehouse was and still is a very intense academic place, so that when you leave Morehouse, you can do a Boston University, a Crozier Theological Seminary with no problem. In my case, now I went into Morehouse when I was turning 17. Now, when I left Morehouse for the University of Chicago, I used, for the first year, half of the books I used in my senior year at Morehouse. And Chicago is ranked, along with Harvard, in the top 10 of 150 different places that offer the PhD. I had absolutely no problem in grad school. And I got there when I was, 20 years old, I guess. And I was reading the same stuff that I had read in political theory. I had the same darn books. And I got mad when I had to buy some new ones. I didn't get angry, but I was saying, all right, okay, the Morehouse business is better than I thought. So King had the benefit of that kind of thing. It was a tradition at Morehouse that we talked about ideas. We talked about justice. We talked about freedom. We talked about the role of government. We talked about, well, Benjamin Mays, the president, used to say to us, being at Morehouse is not only an opportunity, it's a privilege to prepare for service. He didn't tell us what the service was, but every Tuesday there'd be somebody brought in who had been successful, some black person usually, in some field other than preaching and teaching, to talk to us Morehouse men. And King went through that experience as well as I did, saying that you can learn how to teach grammar school at 1,500 other places, but you can't learn how to lead at those places. Morehouse is the place. And King's daddy at the church and King's mentor Mays at Morehouse and King's buddies all were in that milieu of leadership and service. And like most lives, a lot of folks aren't too sure what they're going to do for real. They may have aspirations to do A and end up doing B, C, and D, plus or minus. King had no idea when he went down to Montgomery, Alabama, that he was moving into his, we call it destiny on retrospect, in retrospect. But he was picked to head the Montgomery Improvement Association because he was too new in town to have any enemies among the folks in the black leadership situation. He was 27 years old. He had heard about Montgomery, Alabama, And when he got in town to work at the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, an upscale Baptist church serving Alabama State for blacks, they asked him if he would serve as the spokesperson for the Montgomery Improvement Association, which initiated a boycott, a bus boycott. And with some reluctance, he agreed, and the rest, so to speak, is history.
Martin Luther King's work transcended issues of race, and he went very deeply into the problem of poverty. And even, I mean, there's some wonderful moments in his speeches and sermons where he talks about his empathy for poor white people, including a guy who was his jailer, who he got into conversations with. Was he ever able to build alliances across race lines over issues of class?
Not really. One, the South has had this double class of poverty-stricken folks. I'm reading a book now called The Dispossessed by Jacqueline Jones that deals with this very question, not as King, but as what is the connection between race and class. And in the Deep South, historically, and I'm finding this in my research for my own book, the topic of race has been seen as far more important than the topic of class. In other words, an African-American of the highest income is regarded still as a member of an inferior class and therefore an inferior person. I've had whites say to me when I was doing desegregation work in Mississippi, say to me, it was hard being white while being ignorant, talking to a person like you.
Right.
And so the Southern and to some extent national leadership by default allowed race to be the defining relationship between the groups that were equally poor. We came out in my own life. My folks were exceptions to a lot of rules. We have property that was brought into the family in the 1890s, and I just paid my share of taxes on it in October, 500 acres of land. Now, poor whites used to beg us for a half day's work to get some cash. My grandfather called all white men captain in order to keep the racial thing from coming up again, where the guy would say, don't call me out of my name because I'm a white man. Now, we had a white neighbor farmer who told my uncle, don't call me Henry Edwards. I'm a white man. So here's a case where a white beggar will say, however broke I am, however empty a pocket I am, and however sad I am to be begging, first consider me white, then give me some money, or give me some work. That's how deeply entrenched the class and racial thing was, and King couldn't overcome that. Now, one of the reasons people don't deal with this, and I said it and some other folks said it, when King started talking about money, he was bumping into those who are cleaning up out of the racial segregation system. He's bumping into the capitalists who exploit both groups. And he's bumping into the idea that has not been settled as to what extent are the rich responsible for aiding those who are not rich. And he lost his life just beginning to deal with the issue. When he went to deal with the lowest of the low, people who pull other people's dirty garbage, he got killed. And so the fact of his death on the economic topic is a sign of the role between class and race and economics in this country. He didn't get killed talking about voting. He didn't get killed talking about access to the social amenities of hotels and public entertainment and so on. When he started talking about cash, he was exposing himself, and that's why he made that awfully prophetic speech on the last night of his life. I may not get there. That's a strong statement to say in that context. And within 24 hours, he was dead.
Well, that's another thing I wanted to ask you about. I mean, in a number of King's speeches and sermons, he talks about his own moments of weakness and doubt. He talks about unfulfilled dreams, about how Gandhi, who was one of his great role models, died with a broken heart. And he says, there's a quotation, life is a long, continual story of setting out to build a great temple and not being able to finish it. And there's always that dialectic between walking the path and knowing you might not reach the destination, but trying to reach that destination.
Yes. The French have an expression, c'est la vie. That is the way life works. Sometimes, the Irish had an expression, the best laid plans of mice and men often go astray. In other words, you can't carry a movement through alone with no opposition. You cannot predict how a good intention may turn out, not on the average. And if you look at the lives of many outstanding human beings, leaders, there are these dialectics of hope and doubt. Mother Teresa was revealed a couple of 3 years ago as wondering whether God heard anybody. That's strong for Mother Teresa.
Right.
Douglas MacArthur, there's a new book out on him, where as proudful as he was, he worried about small criticisms of how he looked. He wore a girdle on occasion to look the heroic guy he was. Churchill had these moments when he would get drunk. He was so depressed. Even Charles de Gaulle wondered whether La Belle France was worth the effort. And so King was no exception to that. Gandhi, same thing. In addition to that, Gandhi had more of a vicious fight with his supporters than King had with his supporters. Even though when King moved to economic issues, the Northern support started backing up. The black ministers were saying, don't go there too hard because you'll hurt the people who contribute to the church if they get fired for following you. You see what I'm saying? And the capitalists would say, if he creates a condition where the wages go up, the profits will go down. And if the poor people are radicalized, as the saying goes, we will have something on our hands that we don't want to viciously close down, like they tried to do the labor movement itself. So he was into a thicket of danger and halfway sensed it. But with black garbage men being the symbol of that, and parenthetically, most people who move garbage east of the Mississippi River are black people in the larger towns. It's not that way west of the Mississippi River, so to speak. Think about it. So King took a calculated gamble. And then when he added to this the old business of study war no more against the Vietnam War, that alienated him from a lot of people who, whatever reason they may have, his nation had, saying that this is disloyalty to the nation and to the troops over there. Even though nobody could explain why they were there. As Muhammad Ali once said, I ain't got nothing against them Viet Cong. By the way, where do they live? You know, that kind of business. So he knowingly, however, came to realize that the right to vote without an economic base is a rather thin, though necessary, right. That you must have some balance between going to the ballot box and voting and the economics of the system that sustains everything. And he was trying to begin to address that, and the country wasn't ready. And still isn't, if you think of the health care arguments.
We're talking to Dr. Russell Adams, Professor Emeritus of Afro-American Studies at Howard University. And he will be joining us tomorrow and Thursday talking about the life of Martin Luther King Jr. We're going to listen now to a sermon of Martin Luther King. It's titled Unfulfilled Dreams, and it was delivered at Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, Georgia, on the 3rd of March, 1968, just about a month before his assassination. The recording is not the complete audio of that sermon, but it is the vast majority of the sermon.
Sometimes it's overlooked. It is not one of the most familiar passages in the Old Testament. But I never will forget when I first came across it. It struck me as a passage have in cosmic significance, because it says so much in so few words about things that we all experience in life. David, as you know, was a great king. And the one thing that was foremost in David's mind and in his heart was to build a great temple. The building of the temple was considered to be the most significant thing facing the Hebrew people, and the king was expected to bring this into being. David had the desire. He started. And then we come to that passage over in the 8th chapter of 1 Kings, which reads, "And it was in the heart of David, my father, to build an house for the name of the Lord God of Israel. And the Lord said unto David, my father, whereas it was in thine heart to build an house unto my name, thou didst well that it was within thine heart." And that's really what I want to talk about this morning. It is well that it was within thine heart. As if to say, David, you will not be able to finish the temple. You will not be able to build it. But I just want to bless you because it was within thine heart. Your dream will not be fulfilled. The majestic hopes that guided your days will not be carried out in terms of an actual temple coming into being that you were able to build. But I bless you, David, because it was within thine heart. You had the desire to do it. You had the intention to do it. You tried to do it. You started to do it. And I bless you for having the desire and the intention in your heart. It is well that it was within thine heart. So many of us in life start out building temples, temples of character, temples of justice, temples of peace. So often we don't finish them. Because life is like a Schubert's unfinished symphony. At so many points we start, we try, we set out to build our various temples. And I guess one of the great agonies of life is that we are constantly trying to finish that which is unfinishable. We are commanded to do that. And so we, like David, find ourselves in so many instances having to face the fact that our dreams are not fulfilled. Now let us notice first that life is a continual story of shattered dreams. My Mahatma Gandhi labored for years and years for the independence of his people through a powerful nonviolent revolution. He was able to win that independence for years. The Indian people have been dominated politically, exploited economically, segregated and humiliated by foreign powers, and Gandhi struggled against it. He struggled to unite his own people, and nothing was greater in his mind than to have India as one great united country moving toward a higher destiny. This was his dream. But Gandhi had to face the fact that he was assassinated and died with a broken heart, because that nation that he wanted to unite ended up being divided between India and Pakistan as a result of the conflict between the Hindus and the Muslims. Life is a long, continual story of setting out to build the great temple and not being able to finish it. Woodrow Wilson dreamed the dream of a League of Nations. But he died before the promise was delivered. The Apostle Paul talked one day about wanting to go to Spain. It was Paul's greatest dream, to go to Spain, to carry the gospel there. Paul never got to Spain. He ended up in a prison cell in Rome. This is the story of life. So many of our forebears used to sing about freedom. They dreamed of the day that they would be able to get out of the bosom of slavery, the long night of injustice. And they used to sing little songs. Nobody knows the trouble I see. Nobody knows but Jesus. They thought about a better day as they dreamed their dream. And they would say, I'm so glad the trouble don't last always. By and by, I'm going to lay down my heavy load. And they used to sing it because of a powerful dream. But so many died without having the dream fulfilled. And each of you this morning, in some way, is building some kind of temple. The struggle is always there. It gets discouraging sometimes. It gets very disenchanting sometimes. Some of us are trying to build a temple of peace. We speak out against war, we protest, but it seems that your head is going against a concrete wall. It seems to mean nothing. And so often as you set out to build the temple of peace, you're left lonesome. You're left discouraged. You're left bewildered. Well, it is the story of life, and the thing that makes me happy is that I can hear the voice crying through the vista of time, saying, it may not come today or it may not come tomorrow, but it is well that it is within thine heart. It's well that you are trying. You may not see it. The dream may not be fulfilled, but it's just good that you have a desire to bring it into reality. It's well that it's in thine heart. Thank God this morning that we do have hearts to put something meaningful in. Life is a continual story shattered dreams. Now let me bring out another point. Whenever you set out to build a creative temple, whatever it may be, you must face the fact that there is a tension at the heart of the universe between good and evil. It's there. A tension at the heart of the universe between good and evil. Hinduism refers to this as a struggle between illusion and reality. Platonic philosophy used to refer to it as a tension between body and soul. Zoroastrianism, a religion of old, used to refer to it as a tension between the God of light and the God of darkness. Traditional Judaism and Christianity refer to it as a tension between God and Satan. Whatever you call it, that is a struggle in the universe between good and evil. Now, not only is that struggle structured out somewhere in the external forces of the universe, it's structured in our own lives. Psychologists have tried to grapple with it in their way, and so they say various things. Sigmund Freud used to say that this tension is a tension between what he called the id and the superego. But you know, some of us feel that it's a tension between God and man. And in every one of us this morning, there's a war going on. It's a civil war. I don't care who you are. I don't care where you live. There is a civil war going on in your life. And every time you set out to be good, there's something pulling on you, telling you to be evil. It's going on in your life. Every time you set out to love, something keeps pulling on you, trying to get you to hate. Every time you set out to be kind and say nice things about people, something is pulling on you to be jealous and envious and to spread evil gossip about them. There's a civil war going on. Every time you say that I'm not going to let this evil habit destroy me, something keeps pulling on you, saying, keep on doing it. That is a schizophrenia, as the psychologists or the psychiatrists would call it, going on within all of us. And there are times that all of us know somehow that there's a Mr. Hyde and a Dr. Jekyll in us. And we end up having to crowd with Ovid, the Latin poet, I see and approve the better things of life, but the evil things I do. We end up having to agree with Plato that the human personality is like a charioteer with two headstrong horses, each wanting to go in different directions. Or sometimes we even have to end up crying out with St. Augustine, as he said in his Confessions, Lord, make me pure, but not yet. We end up crying out with the Apostle Paul, the good that I would, I do not, and the evil that I would not, that I do. And we end up having to say with Goethe that there's enough stuff in me to make both a gentleman and a rogue. It's a tension at the heart of human nature. And whenever we set out to dream our dreams and to build our temples, we must be honest enough to recognize it. And this brings me to the basic point of the text. In the final analysis, God does not judge us by the separate incidents or the separate mistakes that we make, but by the total bent of our lives. And the final analysis, God knows that his children are weak and they're frail. And the final analysis, what God requires is that your heart is right. Salvation isn't reaching the destination of absolute morality, but it's being in the process and on the right road. There's a highway called Highway 80. I've marched on that highway from Selma, Alabama to Montgomery. But I never will forget my first experience with Highway 80. Was driving with Coretta and Ralph and Juanita Abernathy to California. We drove from Montgomery all the way to Los Angeles on Highway 80. It goes all the way out to Los Angeles. And you know, being a good man, being a good woman, does not mean that you've arrived in Los Angeles. It simply means that you're on Highway 80. Maybe you haven't gotten as far as Selma, or maybe you haven't gotten as far as Meridian, Mississippi, or Monroe, Louisiana. That isn't the question. The question is whether you're on the right road. Salvation is being on the right road, not having reached the destination. Oh, we have to finally face the point that there is none good but the Father. But if you're on the right road, God has the power. And he has something called grace. And he puts you where you ought to be. Now, the terrible thing in life is to be trying to get to Los Angeles on Highway 78. That's when you are lost. That sheep was lost not merely because he was doing something wrong in that parable, but he was on the wrong road. And he didn't even know where he was going. He became so involved in what he was doing, nibbling sweet grass, that he got on the wrong road. Salvation is being sure that you're on the right road. It is well. That's what I like about it. That it was within thine heart. Some weeks ago, somebody was saying something to me about a person that I have great, magnificent respect for. And they were trying to say something that didn't sound too good about his character, something he was doing. And I said, number one, I don't believe it. But number two, even if he is, he's a good man because his heart is right. And in the final analysis, God isn't going to judge him by that little separate mistake that he's making, because the bent of his life is right. The question I want to raise this morning with you, is your heart right? If your heart isn't right, fix it up today. Get God to fix it up. Get somebody to be able to say about you, you may not have reached the highest height. He may not have realized all of his dreams, but he tried. Isn't that a wonderful thing for somebody to say about you? He tried to be a good man. He tried to be a just man. He tried to be an honest man. His heart was in the right place. And I can hear the voice saying, crying out through the eternities, I accept you. You are the recipient of my grace because it was in your heart. And it is so well that it was within thine heart. I don't know this morning about you, but I can make a testimony. You don't need to go out this morning saying that Martin Luther King is a saint. Oh, no. I want you to know this morning that I'm a sinner like all of God's children, but I want to be a good man. And I want to hear a voice saying to me one day, I take you in and I bless you because you try. It is well that it was within thine heart. What's in your heart this morning? If you get your heart right.
The recording of this sermon, Unfulfilled Dreams, ends at this point. Once again, this sermon was delivered at Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, Georgia, on the 3rd of March, 1968. Because we have some time left, we're going to hear now an excerpt of another sermon from a much earlier time in Martin Luther King's life as a preacher. This is an excerpt from the sermon, Loving Your Enemies, delivered at Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, Alabama, on the 17th of November, 1957. This was less than a year after the end of the Montgomery bus boycott, the event which led to the end of segregation on transportation in Alabama, and in fact led to a Supreme Court decision on this issue.
Far from being the pious injunction of a utopian dreamer, this command is an absolute necessity for the survival of our civilization. Yes, it is love that will save our world and our civilization. Love even for enemies. Now let me hasten to say that Jesus was very serious when he gave this command. He wasn't playing. He realized that it's hard to love your enemies. He realized that it's difficult to love those persons who seek to defeat you, those persons who say evil things about you. He realized that it was painfully hard, pressingly hard. But he wasn't playing. And we cannot dismiss this passage as just another example of Oriental hyperbole, just a sort of exaggeration to get over the point. This is a basic philosophy of all that we hear coming from the lips of our Master. Because Jesus wasn't playing, because he was serious, we have the Christian and moral responsibility to seek to discover the meaning of these words and to discover how we can live out this command and why we should live by this command. Now, first, let us deal with this question, which is the practical question. How do you go about loving your enemies? I think the first thing is this. In order to love your enemies, you must begin by analyzing self. Now, I'm sure that seems strange to you that I start out telling you this morning that you love your enemies by beginning with a look at self. But it seems to me that that is the first and foremost way to come to an adequate discovery to the how this situation. Now, I'm aware of the fact that some people will not like you, not because of something you have done to them, but they just won't like you. I'm quite aware of that. Some people aren't going to like the way you walk. Some people aren't going to like the way you talk. Some people aren't going to like you because you can do your job better than they can do theirs. Some people aren't going to like you because other people like you, because you're popular, and because you're well-liked, they aren't going to like you. Some people aren't going to like you because your hair is a little shorter than theirs, or your hair is a little longer than theirs. Some people aren't going to like you because your skin is a little brighter than theirs. And others aren't going to like you because your skin is a little darker than theirs. So that some people aren't going to like you. They're going to dislike you not because of something that you've done to them, but because of various jealous reactions and other reactions that are so prevalent in human nature. But after looking at these things and admitting these things, we must face the fact that an individual might dislike us because of something that we've done deep down in the past, some personality attribute that we possess, something that we've done deep down in the past and we've forgotten about it, but it was that something that aroused the hate response within the individual. That is why I say begin with yourself. There might be something within you that arouses the tragic hate response in the other individual. This is true in our international struggle. We look at the struggle, the ideological struggle between communism on the one hand and democracy on the other. We see the struggle between America and Russia. Now, certainly, we can never give our allegiance to the Russian way of life, to the communistic way of life, because communism is based on an ethical relativism and a metaphysical materialism that no Christian can accept. When we look at the methods of communism, a philosophy where somehow the end justifies the means, we cannot accept that because we believe as Christians that the end is pre-existent in the means. But in spite of all of the weaknesses and evils inherent in communism, we must at the same time see the weaknesses and evils within democracy. Democracy is the greatest form of government, to my mind, that man has ever conceived. But the weakness is that we have never practiced it. Isn't it true that we have often taken necessities from the masses to give luxuries to the classes? Isn't it true that we have often, in our democracy, trampled over individuals and races with the iron feet of oppression? Isn't it true that through our Western powers we have perpetuated colonialism and imperialism? And all of these things must be taken under consideration as we look at Russia. We must face the fact that the rhythmic beat of the deep rumblings of discontent from Asia and Africa is at bottom a revolt against the imperialism and colonialism perpetuated by Western civilization all these many years. The success of communism in the world today is due to the failure of democracy to live up to the noble ideals and principles inherent in its system. And this is what Jesus means when he said, "How is it that you can see the mote in your brother's eye and not see the beam in your own eye?" Or to put it in Moffat's translation, "How is it that you see the splinter in your brother's eye and fail to see the plank in your own eye?" This is one of the tragedies of human nature. So we begin to love our enemies and love those persons that hate us, whether in collective life or individual life, by looking at ourselves. A second thing that an individual must do in seeking to love his enemy is to discover the element of good in his enemy. And every time you begin to hate that person and think of hating that person, realize that there is some good there and look at those good points, which will overbalance the bad points. I've said to you on many occasions that each of us is something of a schizophrenic personality. We are split up and divided against ourselves. And that is something of a civil war going on within all of our lives. That is a recalcitrant south of our soul revolting against the north of our soul. And that is this continual struggle within the very structure of every individual life. That is something within all of us that causes us to cry out with Ovid, the Latin poet, "I see and approve the better things of life, but the evil things I do." That is something within all of us that causes us to cry out with Plato that the human personality is like a charioteer with two headstrong horses, each wanting to go in different directions. That is something within each of us that causes us to cry out with Goethe, that is enough stuff in me to make both a gentleman and a rogue. That is something within each of us that causes us to cry out with Apostle Paul, I see and approve the better things of life, but the evil things I do. So somehow the isness of our present natures is out of harmony with the eternal oughtness that forever confronts us. And this simply means this, that within the best of us there is some evil, and within the worst of us there is some good. When we come to see this, we take a different attitude toward individuals. The person who hates you most has some good in him. Even the nation that hates you most has some good in it. Even the race that hates you most has some good in it. And when you come to the point that you look in the face of every man and see deep down within him what religion calls the image of God, you begin to love him in spite of, no matter what he does, you see God's image there. And that is an element of goodness that he can never slough off. Discover the element of good in your enemy. And as you seek to hate him, find the center of goodness and place your attention there, and you will take a new attitude. Another way that you love your enemy is this. When the opportunity presents itself for you to defeat your enemy, that is the time that you must not do it. There will come a time, in many instances, when the person who hates you most, the person who has misused you most, the person who has gossiped about you most, the person who has spread false rumors about you most, there will come a time when you will have an opportunity to defeat that person. It might be in terms of a recommendation for a job. It might be in terms of helping that person to make some move in life. That's the time you must do it. That is the meaning of love. In the final analysis, love is not this sentimental something that we talk about. It is not merely an emotional something. Love is creative, understanding, goodwill for all men. It is a refusal to defeat any individual. When you rise to the level of love of its great beauty and power, you seek only to defeat evil systems. Individuals who happen to be caught up in that system you love, but you seek to defeat the system.
Once again, this was an excerpt of the sermon, Loving Your Enemies, delivered at the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, Alabama, on the 17th of November, 1957. We're devoting all this week to Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., and we're listening to some of his religious sermons. We will be joined again tomorrow and Thursday by Dr. Russell Adams, Professor Emeritus of Afro-American Studies at Howard University. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and you can write to me at radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.